Our first case for argument is Owens v. United States. Mr. Malouin. Proceed.
May it please the court. My name is Eldad Malamuth, and I represent the appellant, Mr. Anthony Owens. Mr. Owens requests that this court reverse the district court's denial of his motion to vacate, set aside, or correct a sentence pursuant to 28 U.S.C. 2255. We are here today because Mr. Owens was in fact denied his Sixth Amendment right to effective assistance of counsel. Multiple recent decisions by the Supreme Court make clear that Mr. Owens is eligible for and entitled to relief in these circumstances, where he was prejudiced by the constitutionally deficient conduct of both his trial and appellate counsel in litigating his meritorious Fourth Amendment claim.
Mr. Malamuth, I have two principal questions for you. One of them is to ask why you think that the logic of the Glover case should be extended to this circumstance where, of course, it seems that the principal thing the Supreme Court was worried about in Glover was the notion that even an extra day in prison wouldn't be seriously prejudicial to somebody. People care about where they're spending their time. So that's the first question. The second question is, even if we were to agree with you that Holman, in light of all of these further developments, isn't sustainable anymore, why is this actually a meritorious Fourth Amendment claim? I mean, there are Leon arguments, there are other arguments that might make this a not the best case to take on Holman.
Your Honor, in the Glover case, what the Supreme Court was dealing with was the Seventh Circuit, was this court's rule that there had to be some extra showing of unreliability or fundamental unfairness besides the basic Strickland test.
Well, certainly at a certain level of generality, that's absolutely correct, but we need to be more specific, perhaps, and say, could you possibly say that prejudice hasn't been suffered when you're spending more time? I realize that, believe me, we know DeReeve in this circuit, and I realize that one of the rationales of DeReeve was that you couldn't say that the overall process had offended principles of justice, if it was that kind of a thing. But you have to agree that the context is a little different in Glover.
In Glover, the context is slightly different, Your Honor, but the main point of the Supreme Court's decision is that the Strickland test, the basic two-part Strickland test, governs virtually all ineffective assistance of counsel claims. And the prejudice analysis that was developed in Strickland and later cases such as Kimmelman was not altered by such cases as Nix and Lockhart. The cases both Glover and Holman relied on Lockhart to establish a new element, an unreliable test. And so when the court in Glover clearly stated that Lockhart would not change the basic analysis, it swept away the whole rule. Supreme Court made this larger decision can also be seen by its decision the year before in Williams v. Taylor. In that case, again, the court said that made clear that cases such as Lockhart and Nix did not change the fundamental analysis, and that there was prejudice under Strickland when the criminal defendant was prejudiced by his counsel's failure to adequately protect a procedural or substantive right. In the Williams case, there was an application again, it rejected the Supreme Court, the Virginia Supreme Court, a similar type rule where it required some sort of additional fundamental fairness showing or unreliability besides the basic Strickland test.
Mr. Malamuth, how likely is it really that the district court denied Mr. Owens' motion to suppress on lack of standing? In other words, I realize, you know, that the government argued lack of standing,
Right.
And Judge McKinney assumed that the motion was denied for that reason. But given the facts that were laid out in McPherson's affidavit, wouldn't the district court have realized that he was more than a casual visitor at the house? I mean, you know, he has a key to the house. He mows the lawn. He lists that house as his address when he bought, I think, the pager.
Right. Your Honor, I agree with you that there are many reasons to believe he did have standing. In this case, all we have to go on first is Judge McKinney's opinion that that standing was the reason. Furthermore, to show that in a motion to suppress, the threshold issue that the defendant must show is that his or her personal rights were violated, that he or she had a legitimate expectation of privacy in the home, and there would be no reason for the court to move to the other issues if Mr. Owens did not show that, if his counsel did not show that he had standing. And the fact that there was just a one-line denial of the motion to suppress and no hearing suggests that the Judge Dillon did not go into a complicated analysis of the other issues, which would have merited further discussion.
Well, what about the Leon point, then? What about the fact that there certainly is a warrant in this case, which is one of the principal things we're trying to achieve in this set of rules? And the warrant, even if it's not a perfect warrant, even if it's not even an acceptable warrant, could be enough, and often is enough, to support the good faith exception.
Your Honor, the Leon analysis and logic does not apply if the warrant does not, if the affidavit to establish the warrant does not make a colorable showing that there actually is, has been, that there is probable cause. I mean, in this case, the affidavit established only one alleged sale that took place 3 months prior to the issuance of the warrant. There was no corroborating information. There was no allegation that there was more, that there were more drugs, that there were firearms, that there were any paraphernalia in the house.
Would there be any reason to remand this case, at least, to explore that possibility?
Your Honor, to explore the possibility.
To explore the Leon issue more, since, as you point out, the district court was hardly fulsome in its description of its ruling.
Your Honor, we believe that the affidavit was so facially lacking in any showing of probable cause that there really is no reason to go into that, and that no reasonable police officer could rely on that affidavit.
Why not? I don't understand. What was wrong with the affidavit?
Your Honor, the affidavit had only, as I tried to explain, one alleged sale of narcotics that took place 3 months prior. So there's a three-month gap in which there was absolutely no indication of illegal activity. And there was no reason to believe that there was a large-scale drug trafficking.
Well, it was his house, right?
What's that? Right, that's... but there was no.
It was Owen's house.
That's certainly what the government was trying to prove.
So what is your notion? He went out of the crack business.
Or? Well, there was nothing to establish that there actually was a large scale drug trafficking operation.
Well, the affidavit certainly sets forth his belief that the house is going to contain evidence that's typically associated with cocaine trafficking, such as, you know, the papers, the scales, the firearms,
right,
et cetera.
Except, Your Honor, that there was no reason to believe that there were these scales or papers or firearms in the place. There was one sale, and one sale cannot establish some sort of continuing operation. Multiple courts have discuss the importance of differentiating a single time occurrence and multiple occasions.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Malema. Yeah. Mr. Ostreicher?
May it please the Court, I'm Stephen Ostreicher on behalf of the United States. Mr. Owens' ineffective assistance claim failed because
I didn't understand your defense of the Holman case. It seems very strange. So what you say is that Owens is trying to use the Sixth Amendment to smuggle a Fourth Amendment claim in by the back door.
I don't think the government can contend that.
Well, you use the back door language in your brief.
Well, I think that was simply in a cite to Holman, trying to explain what the Holman rule was. But
how is the fundamental fairness rationale of Holman different from the rationale of our opinion in DeRees, which the Supreme Court expressly rejected in Glover?
As Your Honor earlier pointed out, it was a different context. DeRees was founded somewhat, at least, upon the notion that 6 months in prison is just not enough to it's not enough time to arise to a level of constitutional
prejudice. But the other side of that argument, of course, as I'm sure you're well aware, is that unless the prejudice part of Strickland has built within it this Lockhart notion of fundamental unreliability, the result in DeRees would never have been reached. Because I wouldn't accuse this court of thinking that people don't care about spending an extra month or so in prison, but it was looking at it from a more global standpoint and saying, well, as long as you're inside some legitimate sentencing range, perhaps that established by the statute, there hasn't been the kind of fundamental miscarriage of justice that we look for. So, in fact, it's hard to even rationalize how DeRees could have existed without this notion that was then disapproved in Glover.
Well, I think that Glover and also Williams versus Taylor both make clear that Lockhart and Nix are the exceptional cases.
Right.
But Williams and Glover are situations in which they're distinguishable from this case because they're situations in which the habeas petitioner was trying to claim an underlying right to which he was not entitled.
Well, and that's, I wanted to talk to you about that because the fact is, in the Fourth Amendment area, it's not like somebody says, I want to get up on the stand and commit perjury. You yourself, I'm sure, have many times on direct appeals addressed Fourth Amendment issues.
Have a procedural right to make a motion to suppress. Nobody says this is out of order. You can't make this motion. So even if there isn't some fundamental constitutional right to exclude evidence, it's a procedural right, which is the phrasing used in these cases.
That would be a very strong argument before the in-bank court, I think, and there would be a reasonable.
Well, and that's exactly what your opponent has asked us to do, since we don't overrule cases without involvement of the in-bank court.
But Holman resolved the question and said that Stone against Powell says...
But look, forget about Stone versus Powell. Suppose that you had a defendant who has a whole bunch of state court defenses, state law defenses. They're technical, they're not part of the Constitution, but there they are, a whole bunch of complete defenses, and his lawyer just doesn't assert any of them. So your position is you have to go through them and say, is this really important, this defense? Does this go to innocence, or is this some sort of technicality, or has some deterrent purpose unrelated to guilt issues? Is that's your conception of the law?
Well, Strickland took a pretty pragmatic approach.
Well, yes or no? Is that your view of the law? Well, yes or no?
Yes, I believe that is.
Yeah, well, I don't agree with you.
The simple question.
It's a complete distortion of what the right to counsel means. Right to counsel is you have someone who gets up there and makes the arguments you would make if you were capable, you knew about law and all that. And the arguments are going to be a mixture of technicalities and substantive defenses and so on. In many cases, the defendant just has technicalities, and if he were skilled in law, he would get off because he'd you know, appoint the judge these technical defenses. And you're entitled to have a lawyer who makes those defenses for you. And if they're good defenses, you get off. And that's what the right of counsel is.
But at least in this case, Holman has resolved
it.
In this case.
But tell me, what is it in the affidavit besides one sale of crack that makes it reasonable to think that 3 months later they would find all this stuff?
Well, Mr. Owens says there's no ongoing trafficking.
What is in the affidavit besides the single sale of crack?
The officer's knowledge that there, when you have a sale of crack, and also his experience over the next 3 months
he saw the man mowing his lawn. I mean, somebody could have come to his house on a one-time occasion and had the crack sale, and that could have been it. Mowing your lawn isn't really something suggestive of drug activity, to my knowledge.
No, but the one sale of crack established that at least as of March 22nd, the day of that sale.
One sale happened.
Right. And
it's a totally generic discussion, isn't it?
It is a generic discussion.
How much crack was sold?
I don't. The affidavit doesn't say. It's just simply.
Well, that's kind of important, isn't it? Because if it were, you know, one dose or something, that wouldn't necessarily show that he was in the business. It was a huge amount would show he was in the business.
It wouldn't necessarily, but again, the standards for Leon and Gates are very deferential. The question is whether.
Well, what is there? Do you have any sense of a time limit here? What if this were a year earlier? Would that make a difference?
Yes. If it were a year later, yes. Because there may be some reason to believe that after that amount of time, the guns and.
Well, did the judge who issued the warrant, did he say, you know, 3 months is okay, but not more or something like that?
He didn't say a word about that.
Well, isn't that kind of, we're supposed to do that. So you want us to say 3 months is okay, but a year is too much.
And you also want us to say that, quote, a quantity of crack cocaine must mean a large quantity, not 100 milligrams, which is what a dose might be of crack, 0.1 gram.
Well, again, quantity would have to do with whether after that particular sale he was going to continue to sell.
Well, isn't that the point? Suppose it's a one-time occasion where somebody comes over with one little 0.1 gram baggie of crack.
We can even assume that this was his last sale. The question is
what
whether
if it's
after
the only sale,
then
there's nothing in the house.
The question is whether after 12 weeks the officer would still have probable cause to believe that all those things, that there's any reason to believe during that 12-week span that there was some reason for that evidence to disappear out of his house.
What evidence? Why do we think there's any evidence in the house if somebody's running a crack house someplace else in the city and they happen to go over because it's convenient to meet at Mr. Owens' house that day and they have the one sale and then that's it? Why do we think there's something in the house?
Well, because he sold crack cocaine on that day.
But if he sold it, then there's no evidence, right?
But there may be other evidence.
There may be
in any house on that block.
Not when they're not selling crack out of their house.
Well,
when he made that one sale.
Bad neighborhood.
But
there's no evidence that any of them sold crack. I mean. The point is that, at least as of that day, there can't be dispute as of that day. The only thing Mr. Owens complains about is that, look, 12 weeks passed. So, you know, that's too long to assume that I might still be trafficking.
Well, and what he's actually saying, I would specify more, he's saying if you want to show probable cause that there's evidence in this house, you've got to say something other than the fact that I mowed my lawn and used a key to walk into the house. I use a key to walk into my house, too, and I actually occasionally mow my lawn. So, I mean, pretty much everybody does that. What if the officers had some evidence to show that there was a continuing crack business being operated out of that house, they should have said so.
Right, but they did not. I mean,
so they had no evidence. So why isn't that a lack of probable cause? It's pretty glaring.
Because there was probable cause as of March 22nd. When I don't think this court can hold that had the officer gone to, let's assume the officer had gone straight to the magistrate right away on March 22nd and said, a confidential informant bought crack from this house. Probable cause would support a warrant at that point.
Yes, we know that. Now, you say 3 months is not too much, but a year is too much. Now, how do we decide
where to draw the line?
Yes, exactly.
I don't know the answer to that, except to say that even Mr. Owens' best case, which is United States versus Wagner, a Second Circuit case, there was a single sale of marijuana, and 6 weeks had passed, so more defense favorable, there was a shorter time period. The court there did hold that there was no probable cause. But the court then said, we'd find a Leon argument here persuasive. The government didn't argue that below, so it's been waived. So we don't address it. We find no probable cause. But so even under those similar circumstances, the Leon would be a very strong argument.
Okay. Thank you, Mr.
Thank you,
Mr. Malamud, do you have anything further? How much time do you have? 1 minute?
Just a couple of quick points, Your Honor. First, besides all the factors that we've talked about why the affidavit was facially deficient, there's the added fact that the police officer did not witness the sale, that it was in the house and with some confidential informant. So that's a further reason, a further lack of corroboration that the government did not provide. One further thing is that in terms of whether the exclusionary rule provides a right, the Supreme Court has on multiple occasions referred to the defendant's ability to suppress illegally excluded evidence as a right, and it's something the defendant is entitled to.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Malamud. You were appointed, were you not?
Yes.
So, well, the court thanks you for your efforts on this. Next case for argument.